in Genesis 42, I certainly hope. And we can really stick a lot of the stuff we know about on the chronology of Egypt. This is the statue, I've shown you several times now, of Senusret II. That is not how you pronounce his name in Egyptian, but I can't do that. His father used him as a co-regent for a couple of years, and then he died. And it seems as if the year that his dad died is the year that God sent him the dreams. And so Joseph gets brought up out of the pit, the prison area, and interprets the dream for him. And he is so impressed with this, that is, the Pharaoh is so impressed with all of this, that he figures that Joseph ought to be the one to put all the procedures in place to make the most of all these bountiful harvests that were going to happen, so that when the bad years came, Egyptians wouldn't starve and they would still be able to provide grain outside of the boundaries of their territory. So these are the seven bountiful years. And you see the first spring, because that's when the harvests start, late spring into the summer, was 1894. He only became Pharaoh the previous year. So apparently the dream happened after his dad died. And interestingly enough, Joseph will say later, "I have become a father to Pharaoh." And so he's kind of like the adopted dad for this new Pharaoh. Okay, so the seven good years are over by the time we come to this next section, which is chapter 42. And so the first year of famine is going to happen in the spring of 1887. It's been 21 years since Joseph came to Egypt. So he's now around 38. And his father, Jacob, is around 129. That sounds really old, but on the time scale of these guys, it really wasn't. He's going to live to be, I think, 175, something like that, maybe. Or maybe that was his dad. Anyway, he'll still live a good long time. Now, you need to understand how the famine presents itself to these people living in Canaan. Now, for the people living in Egypt, it comes in this fashion. Every year in September, the Nile starts flooding. And it floods really a lot with lots of sediment, and drops that sediment over the next several months, so that once the flood stage of the Nile is over with, then they can go in and plant. That'd be about January or so. The Egyptians would have known in September, October of the previous year, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Now, the Canaanites, which is where the Israelis are living, they're going to find out in a very similar fashion. But it won't have anything to do with the flooding of a river. It's got the idea rains don't come. Because this is the way that their agricultural year worked. This is from the Gezer calendar. It seems to be a schoolboy's practice tablet, you know, for writing out his letters, but it's something pragmatic. It's the months of the year and what happens in those months. So it starts in the fall. It says 2 months are for gathering, and that's probably for the olives and things like that. 2 months for planting, that would be the planting of the grain, starting with the barley first and then the wheat. 2 months of late sowing, because, you know, sometimes you want to plant a lot more. 1 month of cutting flax. then 1 month reaping the barley. Now that, the reaping of the barley, is actually going to start in the middle of the first Jewish month eventually. But back at this time, the first Jewish month was actually starting in the middle of September, or the second half of September. Because the Exodus will flip it around to the spring instead. Because that's when they exited Egypt, and so it becomes a new start for the Jewish people. But back at this time, the agricultural year was what controlled the months of the year. So let's go back to the very beginning. You see my little blue arrow there? That represents the rainy season. The rains start beginning of or middle of October, and then they pick up and they get really heavy duty through the winter months, and then they kind of start tapering off at the beginning of March. So that's the beginning and the ending of the rainy season, the first and the latter rains that you'll read about in Scripture. You need those early rains in order to put your crops in the ground. And you need those later rains in order to kind of fluff up, you know, the seed heads. And then it needs to turn off dry. In the year that we're talking about, the Egyptians in September, October went, uh-oh, we're not getting our flood. The Canaanites and Joseph's family start going, uh-oh, it's not raining. Why is it not raining? And it wasn't just the rains were late, they never came. So in Egypt, because they've been informed ahead of time by their government through Joseph that this was coming, they're prepared. But in Canaan, they haven't heard any of these stories. They were expecting rain showers. And when nothing happens and it's a completely dry winter, when it comes time to plant in November, December, and January, they're hacking at a hard, dry ground. Whatever they do end up getting into the ground, they're having to hand water. Now, do you think you can hand water, you know, enough acreage of barley and wheat to feed several hundreds of people in your community? And by this time, the larger community for Jacob's family is probably closer to 1,000. You think you can hand water for November, December, January, February, March, enough grain fields? Yeah, they got to feed the animals and water the animals as well. And there are no, I can't say that, there are very few artesian springs that provide water in the interior of Canaan. It depends heavily on an annual rain cycle. The Jordan River is a long ways from where they are actually raising their crops. So when we pick up our story right here, more than likely it is in the springtime, maybe into the beginning of summer, where they have eaten up their grain supplies from the previous year's harvest. And they're looking at the fact, we don't have a seed stock to plant this next fall. And we don't have enough food to get us through until that new crop matures next spring. We're in a mess. We're in trouble. So when we pick our story up in Genesis chapter 42, it seems as if there is a big family meeting where dad, who is 129, has got all his boys, minus the dead one, presumed dead. He's gathered all his boys together to talk about what are they going to do. Now, these are the relative age range for these guys. They range from their mid-40s down to Benjamin. He's the baby, right around 20, 21. Benjamin has his own little boy now, recently born. All these guys are married. All of these guys have kids. All of these guys have servants and employees that work for them who all have families and kids. And there's animals, all of them take care of. So this is a big crisis meeting. Now, any questions of the way I'm setting this up here? Because I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but we need to picture these things in the reality of what it was, what it was like. Put yourself in the shoes of some of these people when you've had a major climactic failure of the spring and winter, the fall and winter rains. And so you've got nothing to get your family through to the next harvest time. And you're worried about, how am I going to put crops in the ground anyway for the next rainy season? Any comments, questions? Okay. Genesis 42. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt. So he's hearing the stories that, yeah, they've had a bad flood year as well. They didn't get their inundation. But they got grain. It's about 11 days' journey. Yeah, about 11 to 10 days, depending on how quickly you move your animals along. 11 days to 2 weeks. So Jacob had seen that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" See, this is the climax of the family meeting. Why are you still sitting there looking at each other? He said, "Behold, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. You go down there. You buy some of that for us from that place so that we may live and not die." So how bad is it? It's apparently pretty bad. He's saying this is life or death stuff here, folks. If we don't have grain to feed ourselves until next spring, and if we don't have enough grain to put in the ground this fall when the winter rains start, we're done for. Then 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. So dad is the head of the company, and all the others are like regional directors. Okay, they take care of things in different areas around Canaan. And so he sent the 10 brothers, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "I'm afraid that harm may befall him." Now, let's be pragmatic about that. Why is he afraid of that? It says, only other son from his favorite wife, Rachel, which you can see in our little chart here. He's the youngest of the family. But, I mean, he's not a baby.
When Joseph went to the brothers, he didn't come back.
Yeah. The last time he had a son from Rachel alone with the boys that are not his full brothers, he didn't come back. See, he's worried about that sort of stuff. I don't know if he's as worried as much about, you know, the brothers doing him harm. I think we may have passed that crisis based on some things that we see later. But he most certainly is worried that the Rachel line will dead end. And so he won't send him anywhere. He keeps him close. I'm guessing that Benjamin probably is on what you'd say the home farm. He's in charge of taking care of things within, you know, the day's commute from Jacob's house, where Jacob sees him go off to work every morning and come back to from work every night. So he's keeping a good close eye on him. So the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. All right, so this gets into what you just asked about, Mark. This is our big satellite map showing Canaan, which is the green patch you see on the upper right-hand side. Then you've got the Arabian Desert off to the right. You've got the Sinai Desert off to the south. So normally Canaan is the big green island there, right? And then that great big green patch by the Med on the left-hand side, and this ribbon down below, that's the Nile Delta and the Nile River. And the little red pushpin, that's the capital of Egypt at this time in history. And yeah, go ahead.
We were talking a long time ago about how Abraham settled in that area up there in Canaan. And
yep.
It was all fed from streams and stuff.
Yes.
Off of the Mediterranean, so that they don't have access to that any longer.
Well, the streams are fed by rains.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yes. Gotcha. The streams are always fed by rains, which bring the water table up for certain springs. And when the water table drops, those springs shut off. We have the same problem around, you know, in the United States. And so that's the problem, is the water table drops quick. All right, so they're leaving from Hebron, and they're going to cut across to the Mediterranean coast, catch the what's called the ancient highway of the sea. It's not paved asphalt, okay? It's just long time, lots of animals and people walking on it, packed down. And so it's a highway of the sea that goes across the northern part of the Sinai Desert, and then it hits the Delta region. Then it follows one of the streams of the Nile, down to the main part of the Nile, which is in the wrist of the Nile, right? The Nile Delta. And then they follow it down to the capital city, which means that they went right past a big thing that we all would love to see, right? That'd be the pyramids. They were probably in a little bit better shape than this at this time, although they were already many hundreds of years old. Yeah, they would have gone right past this. More than likely, the golden cap was still on top of that great big one. And here's our buddy out in the front, right? The Great Sphinx. They might have seen that as well. But...
He wouldn't have been buried either.
What's that? Oh, yeah, he wouldn't have been buried either. Because the Egyptians would have been keeping that all nice looking. Now, we've already talked about this. Jacob's brothers are Canaanites in the sense that they dress like the Canaanites. And so this is what they would have looked like at the time. They would have had this style of clothing. We know because this is a wall painting from the same time period. So this is the style of the time. And you see their beards? Right? So... the Semites from Canaan all had beards and they had nice real hair and things like that. And then you have their conveyance, their trucks, which is their donkeys. And donkeys play a part in the story here. Now, they didn't take any kids with them, so it's just donkeys that they took. And they probably would have had their normal weapons. You can see some of the little curved swords, and there's a bow that one of them's holding and a spear. And so, nice sandals too, by the way. All right, so that's how I want you to picture them as they show up. Now, you got a question?
They look very Greek to me.
These guys are definitely not Greek. Yeah, the beards do look different than what you actually anticipate. Okay? Apparently, they kind of, the Semites kept their beards kind of trimmed.
Like a Jewish beard.
Yeah, a Jewish beard from this time period. I don't know if they had the same makeup that the Egyptians did. The Egyptians might have said, these guys need some makeup to highlight their eyes. But
well, we know the women wore makeup.
Oh yeah, all the Egyptians like makeup.
Well, no, Rachel and Leah wore.
And Rachel and Leah wore makeup. Now, whether or not the guys did, I don't know. They did wear rings in their ears. I don't know if the guys wore rings in their noses, but they definitely wore earrings. A lot of them. Yeah, the girls had the nose rings. All right. So now Joseph, if you want to picture Joseph, what he looks like dressed wise. This is a statue from roughly the same time period of a vizier-level member of society. Okay? So let's zoom in so you can kind of see the accoutrements there. That's how you should picture Joseph. He's got his little special headdress on, and he's got his little fake tied-on beard. Because Egyptians shave off all body hair.
Those are just for pictures.
I don't know. Probably for his sitting. Yes, this is for his sitting. This is his fancy dress. You notice he doesn't have a shirt on, but he does have a higher version of little linen skirt. I can go backwards if you want to be reminded about the linen skirt. The linen skirt goes down mid-calf. And so this is probably very close to what Joseph would have looked like when his brothers saw him and why they didn't recognize him. First of all, they weren't expecting him. Second of all, he looked like a high-placed Egyptian official with his fancy dress and no hair, except for the fake stuff. Okay? Verse number 6. Joseph was ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people the land. Joseph's brothers came and they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. He is administering the sale of all grain products going out to foreigners. He's already got everything taken care of for the Egyptians. That's being taken care of up and down the Nile River because he's got centralized storage places everywhere. So that's all on automatic pilot for him. He's making sure that what goes out to foreigners is legitimately purchased. Now, would you want to sell grain to your enemies?
No.
No, because that might help them be more dangerous to you. Or if you're going to sell it to them, what are you going to do? You're going to jack the price up, or you're going to have all sorts of legal guarantees and things. So he is functioning as an international representation of Egypt, dealing with all these foreigners. So in come his brothers, and he recognizes them. And they come and bow down in front of him according to court protocol. Now, what would that have reminded him of?
His
dreams, because what was one of his dreams? You remember? Yeah, but do you remember what the dream was? There were two of them. One of them involved agriculture. What was it? It was sheaves of grain in the field. He said, he told his brothers, we were out in the field, and all of a sudden, your sheaves bowed down to my sheaf. And here is his brothers bowing down in an agricultural setting, because what are they here to buy? Grain. Now, that might have helped you then to remember what the other dream was. Yeah, it was the heavenly bodies. He saw the sun and the moon and 11 stars coming and bowing to him. And Jacob got in on that one. Do you remember? Jacob said, really, you think that myself and your mother and your brothers are all going to bow down in front of you? And it was these dreams that really prompted his brothers to hate him so much that they wanted to kill him. You remember? They said these words, let's kill this boy, and then let's see if his dreams come to pass. So they were ticked off about that. But here we are. Here they come. Down in front of him. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. Now, one of the ways that he disguised himself to them was this. He still speaks fluent Hebrew. He probably can speak the other related Semitic languages of Canaan. But the moment that his brother showed up, he feigned the need of a translator. He would have brought one of his court officials over. Come here. I want you to function as translator for me. Now that guy might have gone, You're fluent in this language. Why do you need me? But, you know, hey, if you work for a big guy that's number two in the kingdom, you don't say that out loud, right? So everything that's about to transpire happens through a translator. That's going to be important to the story. Okay, any questions as the setting of the stage still? All right. He said to them, through the translator, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams which he'd had about them. He said to them, you're spies. You've come to look at the undefended parts of our land. Now, the literal wording is, you've come to look at the nakedness of our land, which has got some sexual overtones to it. To look upon the nakedness of someone is to basically want to take them sexually. And so his language is quite loaded, that you're basically here to rape our land, which is interesting because there is a bit of a crisis that's going on in Egypt right around this time. And that is the pure-blood Egyptians feel that they are being overrun by Semites who are coming in to work for them and to be around, but there's just too many of them. They're trying to take over our land. We need to stop that. It's not an uncommon thing in history. It happens all the time where people get that attitude. And so he basically accuses them of having bad intentions toward his country. They said back to him, no, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. Now, why would that be important to try to explain? Yeah, they're a family, not a bunch of unrelated guys. Although, they're all within 6 years of each other, age-wise. That's 11 guys, all within 6 years of age of one another. So that's a little bit suspicious, isn't it? But how did that happen? Four wives. All right? So, we're all sons of one man. We're honest men. Your servants are not spies. Yet he said to him, no, you've come to look at the undefended parts of our land. You've come to spy out our land's nakedness. And so he said, they said back to him, your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. But behold, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no longer alive. Now, who's that they're referring to? That's Joseph, the guy they're talking to. So what did they actually think probably happened to him? He probably got worked to death. Because what did they sell him as? A slave.
But they clearly need to continue their lie to their dad anyway, so they probably just always say he's dead.
Yeah, so they have definitely bought into their own storyline here, because they did tell dad he was... Well, they actually didn't tell dad he was dead. What did they do instead?
They
had the ripped up clothing with the special coat of many colors. It's all ripped up and it's all bloody with goat's blood. And they're like, is this your son's? And then he assumed he was dead. And so they went with that. So now they're actually saying it out loud. Oh, he's dead. Joseph then said back to them, it is as I said, you are spies. So he's not cutting him any slack on this, right? And remember, he's putting on a great act here through the translator. So he's like overacting in his own language, which would be Egyptian, and then being harsh in the way that he says it, and then it gets translated to them. And then they're like, no, that's not the story. And they're trying to talk back. And then the translator gives that to Joseph, and then Joseph, no, you are spies. All right? Now, again, put yourself into their shoes. Put yourself into their sandals. How are you feeling right now? A little scared? A little worried? A little nervous? Because this guy is number two in the entire kingdom of Egypt, which is the most powerful kingdom in the area. By this you will be tested. So I'll put you on a test. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Why? Why does he want the youngest one there? It's his baby brother. He hasn't seen him in about 20, 21 years. Last time you saw him, he's just a little bitty baby. Hasn't seen him since. Verse 16, you send one of you that he may go get your brother, while you, nine, remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. If not, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And then for good measure, he put them all together in the pit for 3 days, in the prison. Now, some people think maybe he was doing a little comeuppance there. I don't know. Everything else about him seems to indicate that he was a straight-up guy. But he is putting them to the test. He wants to see, have they changed their attitudes? Have they changed their tunes? Now, I will say this, though. What he says to them to begin with is one of you will go back to Canaan and the rest of you stay. That would have been pretty harsh. Because why are they here?
For food.
To get food. Do you think one of them can take back enough food to take care of everybody?
No, they would probably get in trouble
when
all their food
would be gone. No, they'd be in a mess. So Joseph is going to rethink that and adjust his decree by the time the 3 days are up. Now, do you find it interesting that he chooses 3 days? Why would I ask that question? Because of Jesus. He was in the pit for 3 days for us. Yeah. The number three seems to be a significant number for some of these stories in the Old Testament. How many days for Jonah? Jonah? Three. Yeah. All right, so what's that?
Three in the Old Testament and seven in the New Testament.
for maybe a little bit. For a lot of stories.
The New Testament would be seven.
There's seven in a lot of Old Testament stories as well. There are just certain numbers that get repeated a lot, like 3, 7, 10, 12, and 40. Yeah. There's several people that developed a whole numerology approach to Scripture. What's that? Yeah, the Masons really got carried away with some of that. Yep. I am curious again, though. How do you think they felt during that 3-day timeout?
I'm wondering what the guy going back thought, because the ones that stayed behind, they're actually fit.
Yeah.
11 days?
Yeah, when they're thinking about that, talking about it, maybe that was one of the things they were talking about is, well, who's going to do this? How are you going to take care of yourself? Make sure you don't get attacked, and now keep in mind, they probably didn't bring just like one donkey apiece. Later in the story, there will be a prime donkey for each of them. But that's their personal donkey. I am convinced that each of them had a train of donkeys behind that donkey with supplies on them.
They were a wealthy family, so they
had
plenty of animals.
They had a bunch of donkeys for this sort of stuff. And, yeah, go ahead, Mary. Well, yep.
Keep an eye on him, he knew where they were.
Yeah, and he can relate to that place too. And he also has control of what goes on there. So, I mean, he probably was able to tell the warden, if we're going to call him that, you make sure that they don't have it too easy, but also don't be too tough on them. I want them okay at the end of the 3 days. So don't skimp them on their rations and don't beat them. Just put the fear of God into them a little bit. Okay? That's just my speculation. And then they come back. Joseph said to them on the third day, again, this is through a translator, do this and live, for I fear God. Now that is interesting. He is perfectly aware himself that they serve one God. I don't know whether or not they might have picked up on the fact that this guy knows we're not polytheists. We don't believe in multiple gods. Because that would have been a little bit strange that he would have said it that way. I fear the one God. If you are indeed honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison, in the pit. But as for the rest of you, go carry grain for the famine of your households. And then bring your youngest brother to me, so your words may be verified and you will not die. So you see how he flipped that? Because I'm sure he got to thinking about it after a while and went, wait a second, they need to take a lot more than just one donkey train back. They need to take 9 donkey trains back. And I'll keep one of them here. I'll keep one of the guys here. So they did so. But then they said to one another, so here they are, front of him talking back and forth in Hebrew, right? Thinking that the only one that understands what we're saying here is the translator. They said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen, and therefore this distress has come upon us. So that happened 21 years ago. And they're all ate up with guilt over it in this moment, thinking, we kind of deserve this. because this is all related to what we did to poor little Joseph all those years ago when he was down in the pit, because it was a dried up cistern, remember? He was down in the pit begging us to let him out. Begging us not to kill him first, and then begging us not to sell him into slavery. And he was bawling his eyes out, crying out, making promises. And what did we do? We sold him. But that's not the only thing they were talking about. Look at this. Reuben, who is the oldest of them. So he's about 44. Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not tell you don't sin against the boy? And you wouldn't listen? And now comes this reckoning for his blood." Do you remember that part of the story? Reuben was the one that said, "No, let's not kill him. Let's make a profit off of him. We'll sell him." And then Reuben was planning on waiting until later and rescuing Joseph out of the pit and taking him back home to dad. But he was busy with something when the slave traders showed up. And so when he came back later that evening, Joseph was already long gone. And Reuben was like, well, he was beside himself, because his plan to rescue Joseph was just toast now. This is the first time that Joseph heard that part of the story. He didn't know Reuben was on his side to try to rescue him. That Reuben actually pleaded with them, "Don't kill him," and all of that. And so Joseph, at this point, they did not know, however, that Joseph understand, for there was an interpreter between them. So he turned away from them when he's hearing all this angst. A little bit of repentance sounds like going on. Regret. When he heard all of that, he turned away and wept. Now, it's not just that he turns his face away, because it says that when he returned, he actually turned away as in went into another room. Because he suddenly was overcome with emotion about their clear change in attitude from the haters that they were 21 years ago to the regretters they are now. They wish that they could have done it differently now. And so he goes into the other room and bawls his eyes out, then gets his makeup back together again, right? That. I know she enjoyed it. Then he came back and he spoke to them. And then he took Simeon from them and bound them before their eyes. Now I want you to go back to this chart. Who's at the top of the list for the boys? Reuben. He's the eldest. And he would normally have been the one that you would select to keep as the hostage. But who did Joseph specifically pick? Number two, Simeon. I think that is related to what he just heard about Reuben. That Reuben had actually kind of spoke up for him. And so, why would I stick Reuben in this situation? Yep. Simeon and Levi were the two that killed a bunch of the people at Shechem.
Simeon, bad boy.
Yeah, Simeon was a very bad boy in his younger years. Again, that's 20 years ago, 20 some years ago, and he seems to have changed. But he's the one that gets tapped to stick behind as the hostage for return. And notice he has him bound as a prisoner and taken away. Joseph then gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack. and to give them provisions for the journey, and thus it was done for them. Now, another thing that you should understand is there were no such thing as coins back at this time. Coins are an invention from about the 600s BC. So this is 1,000 years previous to that. So what would happen is gold and silver would, when it was refined, would be made into various shapes for the purpose of transport. And then when you bought something, it would be a matter of weight. How much gold for this? And then they would name a weight. And then they would put the little weight scale on one side and then the things on the other, the gold on the other. Do you see what looks like, I don't know, they kind of almost look like kolaches, little Danishes with cherry centers or something there on the left-hand side? Yeah, Cheerios or donuts. No, those are not. Those are actually little rings of gold, because the Egyptians made their gold into rings, and apparently there's silver as well. And then the little bull's thing that you see on the other side, that's probably a weight standard. Yeah, standard weight. When we refine our gold and silver here in the United States, what shape do we put it into? Blocks, little bars. A lot of the Europeans of the ancient world used to make their precious metals into bars. The Semites, the people in the Middle East and stuff, seem to have made it in little mounds, little doughs. All, in fact, they use a word that's for a bread loaf, little round roll. So what happens is when they buy all of their grain, and they're buying a bunch, you know they are, because they got to feed, I'm guessing, probably about 1,000-plus people from now until next spring. And so if it's summer when they're here, they got most of a year that they've got to feed these people, plus their animals. Plus they have to have seed stock to put into the ground, you know, to presumably grow a new crop for the next spring. So they're going to be buying a lot of grain. When they've paid in their gold or their silver, Joseph tells the people in charge of packing everything up, I want you to slip their little gold or their silver things back into the mouths of the sacks on the primary animals. Just put it back in the top. And then make sure all of them have provisions for the journey. The journey is, like I said, about 11 to 14 days to make that trip. And then the train of donkeys behind them, they're all packed up as well. And so everything is set up for them to depart. And they're probably glad to get out of there, except for the problem they're having to leave Simeon behind. So the next thing they're probably thinking about is, how are we going to explain this to Dad, right? So they loaded their donkeys with grain, and they departed from there. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place. Now you have to understand, this is probably at the very close to the end of their trip back home. Because, well, I'll explain why in just a moment. But they had provisions for the journey. But this guy, one of the sons, apparently had already used up all of the provisions for the journey and went, I'm going to have to tap into my grain sack that's on my personal donkey. And so the moment he opens it up, there at the top of that grain sack is all his gold or silver mounds or rings or whatever it is, just laying there. And it kind of freaks him out. right? He said to his brothers, my money's been returned. It's here, even in my sack. And their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? So what does that tell you their thinking is? This is all payback from God against us for the Joseph incident. They think God has got it out for them. Because now they're going to look like one of them has stolen the value of an entire donkey train worth of grain during a famine, which means it's very valuable. Oh, that's not the worst of it yet. When they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man, the Lord of the land, spoke harshly with us, and he took us for spies of the country. But we told him, we're honest men. We're not spies. We're 12 brothers, sons of one father. One's no longer alive. The youngest is with our father today in the land of Canaan. And then the man, the Lord of the land, said to us, by this I'll know that you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine of your households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me that I may know that you're not spies, but honest men, and I'll give your brother to you and you may trade in the land. So they blurt out the entire story of how they lost Simeon and they need to take Benjamin back on the next trip in order to get Simeon out of hock. And then comes the real kicker. Ready? It came about as they were emptying their sacks. So now they're unloading the donkey train. They're at Hebron. They're where they belong. And each of these remaining 8 brothers, because one of them has already discovered the money in his sack, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. So now it looks like not just one of them is a thief, all of them are thieves. Worse than spies, they are thieves because they stole both grain and gold or silver. What's that?
Grain and silver.